Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast. We were set up in 2002. We go out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, waste and recycling in the Southwest. Plus, a look at Royal Mail sell-off and economics with Somerset businessman Julian Parry. And tracking down Nazi gold. Also, a review with Jason Yannakopoulos of this week's news. And another listen to that amazing guy from America who predicted 9/11, William Cooper. But to start this week, we're having a chat with Julian Parry. Hi, Julian, and welcome to Dialect.
Well, hello.
Now, first of all, tell us about your recycling, because you've been on Bristol Community FM over various programmes for a couple of years now talking about that, and you've got what is quite a fascinating system to completely change the way we recycle things. At the moment, we've got to divide things up into lots of different bins. It's all a little bit cumbersome. Various journeys backwards and forwards to various places. Quite a lot of the stuff is actually just going into landfill anyway. What's going on at the moment? How would you like to change it?
Well, what's going on at the moment is the EU are trying to bring in new regulations that will make it even worse. And what I would like to see is a system which goes back to single, once-a-week collections all in one bag. Now, I've worked out how this can be done, both the collections and the treatment and the disposal, and we can end up with 98% recycling for value, with a single once-a-week collection of normally collected waste. Obviously, we're not talking about bedsteads and mattresses now. What we're talking about is what comes out of the kitchen bin, 98% recycling, with a single weekly collection. And we could also get rid of all those hydraulic lorries and have just large trailers with pulled by electric tugs, so that it could be done out of hours and silent, not disturb the community. And generally, it will be a much better system, because not only would it pay for itself in 5 years, it could then help knock off perhaps a third of council tax.
It's all very well saying that you know everything can be thrown into one, but then surely it has to be all resorted again, doesn't it?
Well, that's very true. It does have to be resorted, but we've found a way of resorting it in an automated and systematic way. And the way this works is that everything goes into an autoclave. Now, an autoclave is a very large machine which will, first of all, apply vacuum, so all the lids fly off and all the unbroken packages fly open. And then you apply steam at high pressure and high temperature, which sterilizes everything, so that by the time it all comes out, all the inorganic entities, like the tin cans and the bottles, have got no paint on them, there's no paper, they're all stripped clean. Whilst the organic material, that's all the fibre, the forest products, that has all been reduced to a flock or a mush that looks like a very dirty papier-mâché. And when all of this is now put over a thing called a star screen, the harder objects all come out as they go across the top of the bed, and the soft organic material falls through.
Well, it sounds like a great theory, but is this actually working anywhere in the world?
No, it's not. And of course, you know, to build a full-sized project which would deal with 1.36 million people's waste, it would cost about £400 million, but it would give you a 100 megawatt power station on the back end of it. And I have just recently written to John Penrose MP, asking him to ask questions of Ed Davey in the House of Commons, and saying to him, look, if you'd sold Royal Mail for 590 pence per share, which it's hit today, instead of the £3.30 you let them get away with, all that money that was literally given away to the city slickers would have provided us with a JTP system across the whole country, free of charge, to service the wastes of 63.7 million people, being the population in this country in the middle of August, and it would have produced perhaps a third of the residential electrical load. That would be about 35,000 gigawatt hours a year, which would have been absolutely tremendous, because the plant would have paid for itself in 5 years. You'd have had all that money back again, And then if this had all been done through the councils would have probably been able to reduce their council tax charges by as much as one third.
Amazing. Now, the only problem here is, of course, if you're burning waste, Julian, you're making quite a lot of nasty pollution, aren't you?
Well, that's not quite true. We've done the studies on it. And our sister company, Succay, have done work on this about the creation of your concerns, which are dioxins and furans. And the way it's all worked is you do not produce dioxins and furans. That's not a problem. Also, the system of generation uses gas turbine engines, not steam, and because we don't lose the latent heat of steam, we would generate at around about 54% efficiency, not the usual for steam, which is said to be 33%, but when you talk to people who know what they're doing with steam, they say, not 33% efficiency, Julian, try 25%, you'll be a lot closer to the mark. So I think we have a system here. And the electrical system was invented by a great guy called Trevor Smith, and his system could in fact double the electrical output of the world without building a single new power station, just by refitting the ones you've got, and it could double the electrical output of the world for the same fossil fuel load that we've got at the moment, less the fuel that my JTP system could provide from municipal waste.
So how can people find out more about this online?
There is a website. It's you type in JTP and you will find me on site telling everybody about it.
That's Julian Parry. What does JTP stand
Joint
for?
Joint Technology Protocol.
Now, Julian, you strike me as a sort of latter-day James Watt. You know, this is a revolution you're proposing here in the way that the world deals with its waste. Quite possibly, it could completely transform the lives of many people right across humanity. James Watt, back when he invented the steam engine, his idea was picked up, taken up, and used massively right across the world. Although, of course, it was mainly in the colonial powers and not in the colonies that these steam engines were allowed to be used and industry was allowed to flourish. But what is it that you think is holding back these kinds of ideas of engineering progress today?
Well, in James Watt's day, they were desperately looking for new means of power, as we are supposed to be doing today. But of course, today we have a very sophisticated vested interests lobby that really doesn't want to see any disruptive technology rising through the system at all.
Disruptive? Disruptive? Are you describing your own technology as disruptive?
Oh, absolutely. That's what it's seen as.
Revolutionary.
Revolutionary, therefore disruptive to the status quo, and therefore not acceptable to the bankers who've got all the, who really want to own everything and control everything down to almost when you go to bed at night. There's a real problem coming in society, and that's something else that I've been having a go at John Penrose about, is that we cannot continue down this path because there is going to be a big problem at the end of an enslaved population that is enslaved to debt.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true, isn't it? A lot more people now are in debt than were before, particularly from a very early age. You know, young people now are being prepared, almost entering into their working lives with massive debts around their shoulders. What's the solution? We all know it's a problem, Julian. What's the solution from your point of view to the economic problem?
I have already spoken with some kids at school, and on Thursday I speak to another 200. And my message to them and to the community tonight is, do not take a student loan or go to university. Make a business plan for yourself, and if the education that you are allegedly being offered at a university is not going to guarantee the supply of a job that will pay for that education, plus the interest on the top, plus the taxes out of the allegedly enhanced salaries, if it won't pay for that, don't take the education. Instead, take a funded apprenticeship and do the Open University afterwards.
Well, that's easy to say, but it's not all these young people will be able to get an apprenticeship. Now, a lot of this problem, of course, is caused by, I mean, we call them the bankers. In the old days, they called them the money changers, the people who have a virtual monopoly, even if it's an oligopoly with several people all fixing the market on printing money. Why is it that this is in private hands, not in the hands of our representatives, such as the Treasury?
Well, that's a very good question, and we need to cast our minds back, if we can, to 1802, and what was foretold by the third president of the United States, one Thomas Jefferson, a man who John F. Kennedy once said was more intelligent than the whole cabinet that he had. Now, what Thomas Jefferson said was that our liberties have more to fear from banking institutions than they do from standing armies. And he went on to say that if the American people allow the private bankers, to take control of the issue of money, then Americans would end up homeless on the continent that their forefathers conquered.
Well, that's fascinating, because of course the same is true here. We have increasing numbers of homeless people in Britain. We've got about 200,000 now, and it's very much more difficult than it was even 10, 20 years ago. If you go further back, even more than that, to actually afford to buy a house now is almost impossible here in this country.
Well,
that's why we've had this help to buy scheme, which many would call help to sell, actually, helping the big developers to sell homes that they can't sell, in order to get people into debt. Now, 95% mortgages. What does this actually mean for the future generations?
Well, what you've got to look back is when I bought my first house in about 1970, I was 24 years old, and I had nearly paid for it in 4 years. Now the first-time buyer is somewhere near 40.
The actual cost of building a three-bedroom house is around about £40,000-£45,000 in terms of material and actual labour. And yet we're paying something like £250,000 for such a house. In London, you're talking about up to £1 million. So lots and lots of what you're paying is actually just for the scarcity value of that home.
It's called profit.
Yeah, lots and lots of profits for these developers. Anyway, I wanted to ask you also, Julian, about Remembrance Sunday and your thoughts about that, because we've seen quite a change over the years, certainly since I can remember, I'm sure since you can, on Armistice Day. Over the emphasis, we were told when I was growing up and up until recently that this was to remember the dead of two world wars. Now it's to remember all the dead in conflicts. I wonder if you think that there's any difference there, and if you feel comfortable about the idea of equating, say, World War II with the war in Afghanistan and Iraq.
I think there's a big problem in that the World War II was a war for our own survival. Afghanistan, Iraq were all about wars brought in so that certain people could get their hands on the oil and falsely steal money from the American people, largely. I would say, was it 23 billion went missing in cash at some point? So there's a huge problem there.
But what about the drugs that massively increased the growing of heroin in Afghanistan too?
Well, absolutely. That could be another reason. I would say the Taliban, horrible people they may have been, particularly to their women, that's another subject. But they did at least control Afghanistan as far as poppy growth was concerned. It only came back when the Americans got in there, and you put two and two together, and you can imagine that some people up at the top of the American society actually wanted that. And the reason that it's all banned is because that increases the scarcity value, and that means there's more money in their pockets. I mean, say, when you look at the number of naughty things going on behind closed doors, anything is possible.
Another thing which strikes me about World War II is that, well, supposedly the Allies won and the Germans lost, except Germany now is doing extremely well economically. It's the economic powerhouse of Europe.
Well, it is. That's very true. And don't forget that it was after the Second World War that, was it Poulenc, the Hitler's swindler, the banker, who Franklin Roosevelt wanted to keep out of the United States. Franklin Roosevelt fell ill. His Secretary of State was then unable to stop the bankers, who regard themselves as a completely separate race on the face of this earth. They got Poulenc into the United States.
Well, not unlike the Nazis in a way. We are the master race.
Absolutely, we are the master race. And I think, of course, if those who can remember, cast your minds back to the McCarthy era or the anti-communists, are you a member of the Communist Party? It was all part of a put-up job to actually crush American society back the way the bankers want it. I mean, say you want a parallel, look at Lenin at Stalingrad. and the defence of well, of Leningrad, of course, it was in those days. You look at the defence of Leningrad, and after that, Stalin said, well done, chaps, come and have a pint up at the Kremlin. And those guys were never seen again. They were murdered because Stalin couldn't possibly have people around who knew of independence. And the same sort of thing applies in this case.
Well, interesting revisiting history in this fashion. And I'm going to land this one on you, Julian, yeah. Because I was chatting recently to a chap called Richard Wardrop. He's an engineer, runs an engineering firm in South Africa, a former British Army officer, who has had some interesting experiences in his life to do with what he believes is Adolf Hitler actually surviving the bunker. Before we hear from him, what are your thoughts about that as a possibility? Do you think it's feasible?
Yes, I do think it's feasible, because there's also the Russians wouldn't let the remains go. They wouldn't let them be tested. Then it sneaks out that the skull that is supposed to be Hitler's was actually female. It is perfectly possible that they had a couple of schmucks in there and who were just blown away to make it look good. That's why they burned the bodies, and Hitler got away. I think it's perfectly feasible.
I know that Stalin, just after the end of World War II, in the autumn of 1945, was complaining bitterly that the Allies were protecting Hitler, at which point there was somebody sent from MI6 over to Berlin to really sort of get the story together as to exactly what had happened to Hitler. Mm. More importantly, in a way, though, the guy who's still alive, Harry Bekov, who's the longest standing member of the Conservative Party, he's been a member of the Conservative Party for longer than anybody else in Britain. He was an MI6 officer in Berlin in April, May 1945, and he demanded to see the body. He saw some tarpaulin with supposedly Hitler's body underneath it, and even though he was an MI6 officer, they wouldn't allow him to see the body because he wanted to see for himself, is this really Hitler? Anyway, let's go now to Richard Wardrop, South African engineer, to get some of his views.
My name is Richard Wardrop. I'm living in South Africa now. I was born in South Africa, brought up in Northern Rhodesia, and spent majority of my life in the UK, starting off going through Sandhurst and becoming a commissioned officer in the British Army. After 20-odd years in the British Army, resigned, went back to my roots as an engineer. And as a consequence of that, met some very interesting people in the Far East who were involved with some quite interesting people. And I met the Marcos family children. Marcos was not dead at that stage.
So these are the rulers of the Philippines?
Yeah, Ferdinand Marcos. I met his daughter, Delia, and I met his son, Michael Jr., whom I got to know very well. I spent some 10, 12 weeks in Singapore with these guys with a very single aim, and that was to try and release some of the Nazi gold, which we planned to use for good purposes. At the end of my time there, I could not believe what I'd experienced and what I'd heard. It came about because I met a guy in the UK who said he had some very important contacts, information, stemming out of what happened to Adolf Hitler and the Nazi gold towards the end of the Second World War. The essence of this conversation was focused on Junior Marcos, who was Ferdinand Marcos' son, and Delia Marcos, who is one of his daughters. I went off to Singapore to meet with, in the first instance, Delia Marcos, discovered that she had, as a child, in the early 80s, the family associated with Hitler. She told me that she'd sat on Hitler's lap in the mountains, in the Philippines, and had been entertained by him. He was a charming guy, and he was hidden up in the mountains, protected by the Marcos regime. I was listening to this and thinking, must be some sort of fairy tale. But the more I listened to it, and the more she told me about what happened, the more I became convinced that there was some truth in it. She said, the best way you can corroborate this is by actually meeting my brother. And I said, well, where's he? She said, well, he's actually in the Middle East. I won't say where, in the Middle East. And he can't leave because he's in prison because he can't get his passport back. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I returned to the UK. This would be about 2004. Returned to the UK a couple of weeks later, flew to the Middle East. You couldn't do it now. I had my bag in my hand. with $50,000 in it and gave this $50,000 to the guy who held Junior Marcos as his, inverted commas, prisoner, and he flew to Singapore with me.
So that was a kind of ransom?
Yeah, it was. And I'll come to that now, because the Junior Marcos story is very interesting. We flew to Singapore. I had at this stage been privy to a very large number of deposit slips for gold around the world, and I had copies of those, signed off by a senior FBI guy and by Junior Marcos and bank officials. And one of these deposit slips was for a bank in Singapore. I won't mention the name of the bank, but it comes from the UK. We fronted up, arranged for, and met with a senior bank official in connection with a gold deposit which had been made in this bank in Singapore. Junior Marcos said to the lady, "We're here to secure the release of this gold." We were met with a Chinese stare. After we'd had a long discussion, we were informed we had to come back in a couple of days' time. So we retired and came back a couple of days' time, the same party, and were told, "I'm afraid that we cannot release what you require, and we can't tell you why." Well, this is somewhat frustrating, because we knew it was there, because he'd said it was there, and we wanted to use it for good purposes, and we couldn't.
Yeah, so another thing that strikes me about the Nazi gold is a lot of it is supposed to have ended up in Fort Knox, and yet there's rumours, Julian, that Fort Knox doesn't actually have any gold in it. What's your thoughts on that one?
I did see a report the other day that it hasn't actually been formally audited for decades. I forget the date now, forgive me. But there is a problem over the audit there, in that it just hasn't been done. There is also the other suspicion that the gold is not, that is in bars, is not what it's supposed to be. I have heard reports of the Chinese, when they accepted some gold not so long ago, had some very special tests done. And I think those special tests were to make sure it was more than an eighth of an inch thick. Because, of course, a gold bar can look like a gold bar, even if it's only got an eighth of an inch of gold on the outside, and the centre is tungsten, which has got the same density at around 18.1.
So the only way you can really tell if you've got gold is to melt it down and see what it is.
Well, get out an electric drill and see if you can go. You'll go through the first eighth of an inch, all right, but if you're hitting tungsten inside it, then you're going to meet a bit more resistance. You don't even have to go as far as melting it down. A Black & Decker and a quarter-inch drill will do the job.
Okay, a bit more from Richard now.
Well, the gold was secreted through, I was told this by Delia and Junior, the gold was secreted over a period of quite a long time, by surface vessel and by submarine, through the Vatican, out through the Mediterranean and to the Philippines. And I can tell you the deposit slips, and I've told very few people about this because it's almost unbelievable, but the gold deposits amounted to millions of tons. Hitler's Pope, that's where it started, isn't it? They were complicit in everything that happened with the secreting of Hitler, and also the gold which the Nazis had seized and expropriated, etc.
Yeah, so this is another aspect he's bringing in here, is the Catholic Church being involved, the Nazi Pope in helping to get war criminals and obviously people with the ability to withdraw some of the massive funds that were looted from Europe, actually being helped to get out by the Catholic Church after the end of the Second World War.
Perfectly possible. I have seen the films in the 1930s of the Catholic Church in all its glory and robes marching with the Nazis. There is no doubt that there was a link there. There is also the accusations that the Roman Catholic Church was instrumental in assisting fugitive Nazi officers of very senior ranks to flee to Argentina, of course, where the Catholic Church was in very high esteem and had a lot of power. And certainly, when you think about it, some organization had to be in place for all those guys to be able to slip the net and get over there. And the Catholic Church looks as if it was a candidate for that role, and perhaps the time has come for it to be asked to justify itself.
Another interesting mechanism that was used to get Nazis out of Europe in 1945 and over to South America was KLM, Royal Dutch Airlines. The BBC did a documentary called A Document, as part of their document series. I think it was about 2009 about that. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the last clip from South African businessman and engineer Richard Wardrop.
Certainly as a small person as I am, if you go along to a bank and ask them to do something which they will not do, then what do you do? How do you force their hand? It's impossible. We as the pawns in the world have absolutely no power. It's somewhat frightening, but it's a fact. We have no leverage on what happens to us. It goes back many, many years in terms of the Rothschilds, right back to the Battle of Waterloo when they started the takeover of the banking system of the world. And the Rothschilds own the Federal Reserve Bank. Most people don't understand the Federal Reserve Bank is not a bank at all. It's a private bank. It's not owned by the American state. It's owned by private individuals. That's in the public arena if you care to read underneath what goes on. And interestingly enough, I was reading an article yesterday about they're about to be appointed new head of Federal Reserve Bank to be approved by Obama. Well, that's laughable. He doesn't approve it. It's a private bank. It's all lip service. It's headline news, but it's rubbish. It's absolute rubbish. We're duped. We're led astray by these people who purport to be our leaders. I think we're on course for the unification of the world monetary system, and it all stems back to the control of the world system by several very large, powerful families.
Yes, that's really very interesting, and it accords with what I've learned and what I believe. And of course, if we want to go back to the roots of the Federal Reserve, what we need to do is to take ourselves back to the Jekyll Island meeting in 1910, when the senior bankers gathered in secret, high secrecy, on Jekyll Island, because there had been a huge complaint about the money masters. And in actual fact, I've got a cartoon of the money masters at work even in Abraham Lincoln's time, the money machine. So there was some criticism coming forward then, and the money masters got onto Jekyll Island and they agreed the system by which they should be controlled. You know, excuse me while I laugh and fall off the chair. The truth of the matter is they put together the Federal Reserve Act, which Woodrow Wilson finally signed into law in 1913, just after he'd been freshly elected. Now, it was the Warburgs who'd paid for his election. One of the bankers had paid for his election. And 2 weeks after he became president, it's recorded that he said, "I am a most unhappy man. I have ruined my country. I have made its system of production subject to its system of credit now in the hands of private bankers." And so it has proved to be. And what we are witnessing now, with all the controls that are coming in, even today with Cameron selling off Royal Mail, trying to sell off the East Coast Railway Line, causing chaos by closing A&E departments and GP support services. So there is chaos, and then the cry will go up, "Oh, we need private industry in here," and then they can sell everything off that the state and the people have ever created. They can sell it off all to their friends in the city, and they will build us up with debt after debt after debt whilst China rises, and then the bankers will leave us. And they will go over to China and they will say, "We've got a pot of wealth over here. We've got a pot of debt over there. We're going to pour one from one into the other. And we as bankers, all we need to do is sit on the bank of the river and make sure our ladle is pointed in the right direction."
Fascinating. Julian Parry, Somerset businessman, thank you very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
And now I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos to go through the week's news. And also we've got part two of the interesting little interview that I dug out for last week with William Cooper. Jason, where do you want to start? Do you want to do some news, or should we go straight in at the deep end with Bill?
Shall we start with some news?
Okay. Then? Austerity forever. And now, who's saying this? Obviously, it can't be the Prime Minister, because his job is to stop the austerity.
I'm afraid it is the Prime Minister. Austerity forever, spending squeeze to continue, says Cameron. He says a squeeze on public spending should continue and result in a permanently slimmed down public sector. He says that he will continue austerity measures should the Conservatives win the election in 2015.
Okay, so who is paying him to destroy the country?
The
people. Does it say that in the article? Because I don't remember people voting for him to destroy the country.
No. He attacked Miliband, increasing public spending should Labour win.
Well, I mean, we're going to have to increase public spending, aren't we? If we're going to actually get out of recession, get growth, the basic economics, like per first base.
But then again, as we all know, Gideon's degree wasn't in economics, it was in modern history.
Gideon's?
Yeah.
Who's that?
George Osborne, his real name is Gideon.
Oh, is it really? Oh, gosh. So he's very good at modern history, but he doesn't understand economics. Do you think maybe that he was put in purpose as Chancellor because he doesn't understand money?
Almost certainly.
you go back a few years to the 1700s, and there was something called the Hellfire Club. The Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time, Francis Dashwood, was a member of the Hellfire Club. They used to have raving parties, and he nearly wrecked the economy before he got thrown out. I wonder if the same might happen with George Osborne and his Bullingdon Club.
I wish we'd be lucky.
Okay, another Conservative, a jab at the Conservatives. I'm amazed you don't actually have Private Eye this week, Jason. You've got just the Eye you've got these stories from. A Conservative MP has been claiming expenses to power his and heat his stables.
Yes, this is Nadim Zahawi, who is a Conservative MP for Stratford-on-Avon. He has apologised and forced to repay part of the £5,822.27 expenses claim for his energy bills.
But I mean, this is actually surely part of, it's almost like a sort of supplement to his transport budget, you know, for, does he use the horses to go backwards and forwards to the House of Commons?
No. He went up with an electricity price table. He is founder of market research firm YouGov. And the survey says no.
So to him.
He was mortified to discover the error, which came to light after his among politicians criticised over subsidised energy bills.
Oh, so frustrating. So, yeah, the survey says you're sacked. So, who was that again?
The man in question was Nadim Zahawi.
Tory
MP for Stratford-on-Avon.
Don't vote for the man who steals our money to heat his horses and his stable. Are we allowed to say that?
I think that might be pushing it.
Right. Anyway, UK Marine, on a more serious note, murdered a prisoner in Afghanistan. One of the things that's puzzled me about this, first of all, it's a military tribunal, Jason. Mm-hmm. It's not an ordinary court. And also, we're not allowed to know the names of any of these people. Why is that?
That's a very good question.
Okay, so what do we know about this case? If we're not allowed to know the defendant's name...
What we're allowed to know is that he was a Marine, and his helmet camera showed him... Actually, in fact, there's three... There are two people there, and one of them's wearing a helmet cam, and it's viewing literally Afghanistani prisoner being shot.
Now, one thing that this immediately makes me think, call me cynical if you want, is that let's have a trial of a very low-ranking squaddie rather than a trial of either somebody like Tony Blair or a senior general.
Well, I suppose the argument for that could be that these people were involved directly in the killing of a prisoner rather than killing an entire nation in general.
Okay, so one act, but you know, it does seem interesting, doesn't it, how we don't really see any of the senior people.
It's actually amazing, in the Eye they've even provided a transcript of what was on the video, which is amazing. It's actually literally here in front of me.
Okay, just read a little of that out then, Jason.
Alright, it says, "Anybody want to do first aid of this idiot?" says Marine A. To which the other two say, "Nope. I'll put one on his head if you want." There's some laughter. That's Marine C. Marine C then says, "Take your pick." Yeah.
I mean, this is horrific, isn't it?
Yeah.
Treating somebody in this way. Actually, I mean, you do wonder if it's just pure racism. If these people are actually racist and they're treating this person as dirt,
it does actually get worse.
I think we better leave it because it is getting a bit horrible. I think we can almost imagine what's being said, Jason.
I mean, imagine how it must feel for the Afghanistani prisoner. We don't even know if they were Taliban. It could have just been a random Afghani man who's been stopped. It does say here that the Butterfield execution took place after the trial found a Taliban fighter, so it does actually say he's a Taliban fighter.
Okay. The other thing, of course, is that this is a massive recruiting tool, this kind of thing, for the Taliban. I call me cynical again, if you wish, but I wonder whether this sort of stuff is put out deliberately in the press in order to keep the war going. Because it doesn't seem to me as if they really want to stop things. They want to keep this conflict going.
Well, war is money, as a lot of people will tell you.
Okay, the energy investors, another story, are threatening to pull. Now, who are these energy investors? They're threatening to pull the plug on the big six energy firms. I suppose they're hedge funds and people like that, are they?
Well, somewhat anonymous to this article, actually. No, they are hedge funds. It does say, it does talk to one fund manager. States yesterday, and these funds are going to pull investment on energy if Labour, who came up with the plan, go ahead with their price freeze.
Right, so who's running the country? Not the politicians, it's the hedge funds. And they're saying, well, if we don't like what you politicians do, we're just simply going to pull out investments from the energy
companies. Yeah, so it's effectively allow us to be mean nasties with your money, or we're not going to invest.
So in fact, in a weird way, this one story tells us so much about how the world works, doesn't it? If a politician comes up with a good idea, the city and the hedge funds find a very, very simple way of just simply phoning up whoever it is that the policy is about. In this case, it's the energy companies. And say, you're not doing that. And if you do, we're going to tip you over the cliff. So it's almost like they're acting almost like suicide bombers in the room.
I think they're acting like the mafia. It'd be a shame if something happened to your country now, wouldn't it?
Okay, well, that's it for our little news review. Let's move on now to the William Cooper. You may have heard the first clip from William last week. And here he is talking really about how the world really works, at least how he says it is. And the reason we're doing this is because it's just coming up to the 50th anniversary of the assassination of US President John F. Kennedy, which was really a hiatus in American politics. It represented really the day that America lost its democracy. It's 50 years pretty much now since the November 1963 assassination of the US President John F. Kennedy. In a way, it marked the end of US freedom, the beginning of the takeover of the US by the financial elite and the military industrial complex. Over the next couple of weeks, or last week and this week, we've been hearing from US radio host William Cooper. He was an ex-naval intelligence officer who had his own FM and shortwave show based at his home in Arizona. In July 2001, he actually predicted a massive attack on the United States, which he said on his program would be blamed on Osama bin Laden, before his untimely death just a few weeks after the 9/11 attacks. The FBI turned up outside his house and there was a gunfight and Bill was shot dead. Anyway, he believed secret societies following the ancient mystery schools were the real power behind the scenes in many parts of the world. That the kings that we see, the presidents and the prime ministers, were actually really just the tools of the priesthood. And it was to these groups working within the intelligence services that John F. Kennedy was sacrificed on the 22nd of November 1963. So let's pick up now where we left off last week.
Am I attacking the church? You better believe it. All churches, all organized religions that have existed since the beginning of the time. Am I attacking the religion of individuals? Never, not on your life. He wasn't trying to create a big church. He knew what happened to those things. And you're all wrong about that man. When you say he shouldn't get angry, he shouldn't curse, he shouldn't do things that upset other people, because that's what Jesus spent his whole life doing. He threw the money changers out of the temple. Don't you think that made some people angry? Don't you think it was rude to walk up to somebody's place of business, smack them in the mouth, grab their table, and throw it out the door? What about the time he cursed the fig tree? You know, pious Christians sometimes make me very angry. They don't even know Christianity. They don't know the man they're following. He was a revolutionary. He was a dangerous man. And by God, so am I. And so should you be. This country was founded by dangerous men.
Amen.
And the moment the people in this country cease to be dangerous men, it's going to be the day we cease to have a country. Their whole goal with this philosophy is to teach all men and women that the only end of life is to seek the utmost pleasure and happiness that you can get out of it, because when you die, there's nothing else. That's what they teach. That's what they want you to be. They don't want laws against sexual promiscuity. That's why they don't want families. That's why they don't want marriage. That's why they encourage homosexuality. There's a method to their madness. There's really not much method to yours, because you're operating from a place of ignorance. And until you change that, you're going to be bumbling around, bumping into each other, saying and doing the wrong things, not understanding the nature of your enemy. And if you don't understand the nature of your enemy and the weapons they use, you cannot fight that enemy. You can't fight the battle. You shouldn't even be on the battlefield. That's why you're losing the war. And don't tell me you're not, because I'm in a place of great knowledge about who's winning and who's losing this war. And I can assure you, you're losing the war. Doesn't mean it can't be turned around. But it'll never be turned around until you learn what you need to know. You don't even recognize half the weapons that they use against you. And some of them seem so insignificant that you don't even try. They want to create a world where everybody is happy all the time, doing all of the things that, if you're from a good religious upbringing, is wrong to do. If you're not from a religious upbringing, but you have a good brain and you understand the purpose of morals and ethics, it's still the wrong thing to do. If you're a thinking person. And then the priests had an army. Oh boy, weren't they happy with that? Their whole purpose throughout history has been to teach a small number of people how to become adept at controlling everyone else and presenting their societies as desirable to the profane, so that you'll go knock on the door and say, hey, can I be a member and be initiated, with the promise of learning some great secret. What is that secret? The secret is what I have just told you this morning. The secret is how to control everybody else. And you never understand how to control everybody else until you get to the top of this pyramid of initiation. Most people never make it past the third step. All above that are carefully chosen and nurtured and taught. And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy. That's what Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt determined at Yalta. Who was going to be the enemy post-war? Turned out to be Stalin. And there was going to be this phony Cold War so that the population would never discover the real enemy. And I'm talking about the population of the Soviet Union as well as the rest of the world. You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces, who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries. The
very highest degrees of which, combined together, make up a secret order known as the Illuminati. Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system. Now, do you think they're succeeding? Yes. Haven't I described to you just now exactly what is going on in the world today? Yes, they're succeeding. They're succeeding because the American people don't understand their enemy. They don't even know what's happening.
That's final excerpt there from Bill Cooper. Now, Jason, pretty extreme stuff, actually. He's talking about watch out for your brother, your mother, your aunt, and that kind of thing.
That is
a bit shocking.
That is shocking. I mean, I'm always a little wary of my sister every time I encounter her. But
I think what he's saying there is that, you know, whether these people are actually a part of secret societies, and particularly Freemasonry, is, you know, it can be actually very divisive if it's in a family, because people swear all these oaths which are loyal to the cult, the religious cult that it is, rather than actually to the family itself. Anyway, chained to a computer, that one struck true with me, saying this is what people are going to be in the future, everyone chained to a computer. But what about that point you was making about the phony Cold War? Because that's another thing that I wonder, you know, a phony Cold War? Well, how real was the Cold War, do you think?
Well, I think it depends on time. I think when it started, it was probably a phony war. You had these allies who had just overthrown a great evil such as Adolf Hitler. So, at first, they were pretty united. I mean, if you look at what happened immediately after the war, the one person who was pushing for a war between America and Soviet Union at the time was General Patton, and General Patton died in a car accident shortly after.
But, I mean, it seemed to be loads and loads and loads of arms build-up, but not actual fighting, and I suppose that's because of the nuclear weapons keeping
the peace. It's always that question, isn't it? Who's going to be mad enough to push the red button? And I don't think there's a person alive who's mad enough to push the red button.
Oh, don't you believe it? Don't you believe it? There's always some crazy person out there. Anyway, Jason, what do you make of Bill, ultimately? Because he is a little bit right-wing, isn't he?
Yeah, some of the stuff he said sort of made me jump a bit, sort of suggesting that allowing homosexual relations is somehow a bad thing.
Well, he was saying promoting, wasn't he? Promoting homosexuality was a bad thing. But he's coming from a Christian point of view, basically. There.
Yeah, okay, I can understand that.
And I mean, he's saying basically that the secret agenda really behind the scenes is just trying to encourage people just to simply indulge themselves in pleasure and really throw away morals. And that's certainly something I can see.
Yeah, that is definitely something there.
All right. Well, anyway, Jason, thanks very much for helping me go through some of that amazing. Whether it's good or bad is another question. That's up to you, listeners. William Cooper and his take on the death of John F. Kennedy.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, Jeff Sparks with the What's On Guide. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Tony. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 15th of November, Amon Amarth will be performing with support from Carcass, Bleed From Within and Hell at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £18.50 in advance and doors open at 6 p.m. Also on 15th of November, Fleetwood Mac will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and £10 on the door and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Brooks Williams. He hails from Statesboro, Georgia, and is a singer, songwriter, guitarist who has released almost 20 CDs in his career. This is from the album Baby O, which was released in 2010, and it's the track Baby O.
There's a soft rain falling. It's a hard day, cause my ever-loving baby's 1,000 miles away. Baby O, baby O, baby O, baby O, 1,000 miles away. Oh, it's such a hard time pulling sugar from a telephone when you hang up, you're in the dark all alone. Baby, oh, baby, oh, baby. baby, you're in the dark alone. Oh, these miles can be so cruel, grind you down into a lovesick room. Mind is racing, your bed's on fire, and your heart's a burning flame. Baby, oh, baby, oh, baby, oh, your heart's a burning flame. Oh, these miles can be so cruel, grind you down. There's a soft rain falling. It's a hard day, 'cause my ever-loving baby's a thousand miles away. Baby, oh, baby, oh, baby, oh, baby, oh, a thousand miles away. Baby, oh, a thousand miles away. Baby, oh, baby, oh, baby, oh, baby, oh, a thousand miles away.
That was Brooks Williams with Baby O from the album Baby O, which was released in 2010. More information you can check out at www.brookswilliams.com. On to Saturday, 16th of November, and if you enjoyed listening to Brooks Williams, then you can go watch him at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 each, and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on a Sunday, 17th of November, King Prawn will be performing with support from Imperial Leisure, Random Hand, Dirty Revolution, and Mr. Zippy at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance, and doors open at 7 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening, and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Are you a regular listener to Radio Bristol, Jeff?
I listen to it occasionally, yes.
Because I was fascinated to hear today, this is Tuesday, actually, no, I don't think I'll even say that. I was fascinated to hear this week, listening to Laura Rawlings in the afternoon, chatting to Hugh Cornwell, who was one of the members of the Stranglers, and he was rather wonderfully ticking her off as the BBC for Britain's Got Talent, saying actually what it's proving to him is that Britain's got no talent, or that at least the BBC has got no talent. And if they had a game show or sort of show like that, a talent show, where they actually had new bands with real talent and original stuff, then he wouldn't mind being on the panel. But as it was, he would never watch that sort of nonsense on the television, and I thought it was quite an interesting comment coming from Hugh. Also, she called him a punk rocker, which I don't think he didn't really agree with. I mean, he's not, you know, it was certainly post-punk new wave, but not really not really punk, the Stranglers.
No, they weren't.
But nice to hear the voice of Hugh Cornwell on the radio this week, even if it was Laura Rawlings interviewing him.
That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. You can subscribe to our RSS feed online or the email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from Dialect Radio, one word, .co.uk. Thanks to our studio guest, Julian Parry, and also, of course, Jason Yannakopoulos, to Jeff Sparks, and to our studio engineer, Dave Bozanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
prese la palma. Yo soy un hombre sincero. ¿De dónde crece la palma? Antes de morir me quiero echarle zarzos del alma.
The words mean I am a truthful man from the land of the palm trees. And before dying, I want to share these poems of my soul. My poems are soft green. My poems are also flaming crimson. My poems are like a wounded fawn seeking refuge in the forest. The last verse says, con los pobres de la tierra. With the poor people of this earth, I want to share my fate. The streams of the mountains please me more than the sea.
Me conocemos que el mar.